During the 2012 election campaign, both President Obama and his challenger Mitt Romney called for ever tougher sanctions on Iran in an effort to prevent that country from developing a nuclear weapon. For the record, Iran denies it's seeking a weapon, maintaining it is working to develop nuclear power for civilian purposes only. Unilateral U.S. sanctions have been layered on those imposed by the United Nations, the European Union, and other governments. The multifaceted economic embargo is making life continually harder for ordinary Iranians. Much as the decade-long sanctions against Iraq from the end of the First Persian Gulf War to the 2003 U.S. invasion impacted the lives of ordinary Iraqis more than that of officials in Saddam Hussein's government. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joy Gordon, a professor of law and philosophy at Fairfield University, who wrote the definitive book on the Iraq sanctions and has followed the situation in Iran closely. Here she discusses how so-called targeted sanctions, designed to focus on the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, have led to life and death consequences for many ordinary Iranians.
The UN sanctions themselves are actually fairly narrow. They're crafted to address nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, and they also have an evidentiary requirement. So, for example, they ask member states to seize cargo of a ship if they have reasonable grounds to believe that the ship contains equipment related to nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles. And that's also true for financial transactions and for transfer of technology and so forth. But what's really doing the great damage in Iran are the unilateral sanctions imposed by primarily the U.S., but also the European Union, Canada, Australia, Japan, and South Korea. Those are just wholesale attacks on Iran's entire ability to function financially, on its energy sector, and on its imports and exports. So whereas the Security Council sanctions require member states to see that their banks don't participate in financial transactions that could contribute to nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles, the U.S. sanctions on the financial networks are entirely different. No bank in the U.S. may transfer any funds to any Iranian bank or to a third bank, which might in turn transfer it to an Iranian bank. No Iranian bank may have a branch in the U.S. The SWIFT network, which is the network that permits banks to transfer funds to another bank in a different country, it's the fundamental machinery for financial transfers internationally. It's the only one of its sort. There's no real workaround. There's no other way to do a financial transfer if you don't use the SWIFT network. And last July, the United States persuaded SWIFT to simply cut out all Iranian banks altogether. So what we're seeing is whole-scale damage to Iran's basic ability to engage in any financial transfers, in any shipping, in any sale of oil, in any development of its energy sector.
I know you had researched extensively the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iraq. Are there that level of impacts on the civilian population in Iran now?
The first sanctions were imposed in 1979, but the Security Council sanctions are much more recent.
Who imposed in 79? You mean U.S.?
The U.S., yeah. We see in Iran a redrafting of the sanctions in a way that looks like they're very different from the sanctions on Iraq. The sanctions on Iraq, simply on their face, prohibited Iraq from importing or exporting anything except for very limited exceptions, which were then in turn undermined by the Security Council members individually. In the case of Iran, the sanctions on their face look very narrow and very reasonable. And then what happens is that there are states, the U.S. and others, that then impose their own sanctions. But also what's interesting to me is if you look at the Security Council resolutions closely, they say the member states shall exercise vigilance over shipping, over financial networks, and so on. So they don't say flatly, you should cut Iran off from any financial transaction of any sort. So they just use these terms like exercise vigilance or used enhanced monitoring. But it's unclear what those mean. Those are very vague terms. And so then what happens is the U.S. and the EU and a few other countries then say, we have been called upon by the Security Council to engage in, to exercise vigilance, and here's how we're going to exercise vigilance. We're going to do it by blocking every transaction of every sort through every bank that could ever end up in Iran in any fashion. And we see that now coming about in very absurd extremes. So, for example, in the U.S., Iranian Americans are legally permitted, at least in theory, to send money to their relatives in Iran. And many have for years. They send money to their elderly parents. But even though they're permitted to send these remittances, there is no bank that they can legally send any money through at all, nor can they send it through informal procedures. So the result is that even if this is permitted in principle, in fact, it's not possible. In addition to the actual sanctions themselves, there's a chilling effect that not only are companies abiding by these very extreme measures, but because they are so fearful of prosecution, given how high the penalties are, then they're also erring on the side of not doing anything that might be interpreted as a violation.
That was Joy Gordon, a professor of law and philosophy at Fairfield University. Her book is titled Invisible War, the United States and the Iraq Sanctions. Find more information on the effects of economic sanctions on civilian populations on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.